This episode is brought to you by Too Faced Cosmetics and Better Than Sex Mascara. The name literally says it all. This mascara is that good. There is a formula for anyone and everyone available in original, waterproof, and chocolate that thickens, lengthens, and curls to give you all the drama and volume. Or try the new Naturally Better Than Sex. It has a 98% naturally derived formula. Shop Too Faced Better Than Sex Mascara at Sephora today.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. These days, humor is doing a lot more than making us laugh. From The Daily Show with Jon Stewart to the bristling one-liners President Bush tosses off at his press conferences, humor is more likely than ever to skewer its target. Take Stephen Colbert on the president at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
The greatest thing about this man is he's steady. You know where he stands. He believes the same thing Wednesday that he believed on Monday. No matter what happened Tuesday.
And they all laughed. This hour On Point, political humor takes charge. We'll look at what it tells us about ourselves and our country. You can join the conversation. What makes you laugh at the state of the world today, at the players in it? And is politically charged humor bringing insight, evasion? Is it bringing the news? Joining me in the studio today is Paul Lewis. He's professor of English at Boston College. His new book is Cracking Up, American Humor in a Time of Conflict. Paul Lewis, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom.
I expected a joke tie, but maybe not. And with us from New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
We've got a lot of tape up our sleeves. We're going to hear from the shows we're talking about and from some people working in the humor business. But, Paul Lewis, you've been paying a lot of attention here. We've always had politically charged humor in this country, but you're looking at something new going on or a resurgence of the edge on that politically charged humor?
Well, I think it's true. I think that there's been a polarization in our politics, hardly news, over the last 10 years, maybe 20 years, and culminating in the latest series of elections. And that kind of polarization generates humor, which puts people at each other's throats. So, I mean, I think the first distinction we might attend to would be the one between humor in politics and humor about politics.
Humor in, humor about, and of course, just plain humor looking around the world. Let's get some more of it in our ears. We go here a little more Stephen Colbert. More recently, here he talked about this week about the poison spy case and the fact that Vladimir Putin has been implicated in the incident.
Unfortunately, I know one person who didn't get the chance to sit down with his family and count his blessings. I'm talking about Vladimir Putin, who was accused of killing a former spy. People around the world are pointing fingers at the Russian president for this, but I'm pointing more than my finger. I'm pointing my whole hand and then hitting it with my other hand. It's called applause, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I'm not condoning murder here, just strong leadership. It's what we need, which is why, once again, I am proposing Vladimir Putin for U.S. president in 2008. There you go. He'll make a great candidate. Now, some say killing a vocal critic 2 years before the election is going negative too early. But the American people are against attack ads, not actual attacks.
Jack Beattie, there's a round trip with Stephen Colbert. He goes after Putin and brings it right back to Washington. Strong leadership, a little negative, though, killing 2 years before the vote.
Yes, and you know, that's the trouble with this humor. I mean, he's joking about somebody being murdered. And we're going to hear later on a similar joke or a setup for a joke about the 3,200 people who've been killed in Iraq the last month or so. And my thought when I heard that joke, which was a Jon Stewart setup, was, you know, just earlier in the week, Bob Herbert in the New York Times had drawn our attention as Americans to our responsibility for those murders, to our moral responsibility for what's happening in Iraq. It's often said, oh, these people can't live with one another. They're killing one another. Well, they weren't doing it before we arrived, before we broke everything up. And but, he was saying we should feel bad about that. And here's Jon Stewart and Colbert joking about it.
Well, but here's the bitter with the sweet, Paul Lewis. I mean, sweet, depending on your perspective, and everything has many perspectives these days. But here's Colbert sort of having fun with strong political leadership and just how outrageous that can get over the Russian spies murder. But then that puts death in the middle of a joke. Fair game or out of bounds?
I'd say fair game. Stephen Colbert is the most consistent satirist working in America today. He's always on his own point, and he's always representing some wildly distorted, exaggerated version of a far-right political view. So, of course, he's not laughing about the death of that Russian spy, and he's not celebrating political hostility and aggression and violence. On the contrary, he's exploding it by carrying it to a reductio ad absurdum.
So we're putting important things on the table. I mean, Jack, let's listen for a minute. Compare that. Okay, there's a death in the middle of a joke. On the other hand, David Letterman this week, picking up on a poll about John Kerry, and you've got the old style of humor. Does this really cut it? Here we go.
Well, John Kerry, poor John Kerry. They had a survey, they had a poll testing the likability of Democratic candidates, and John Kerry in this poll about likability finished dead last. Dead last. Ian. And, you know, guys like this take this stuff seriously. I mean, he was very, very upset. He's been walking around all day with a long face.
Bada boom, bada boom. So, Jack, would you rather have that? You know, a long face? I mean, it's okay, it's funny in an old way, but, you know, is that getting to something really that matters?
Pretty tame, isn't it? Pretty tame. And but, you know, that long face reminds me of something. It used to be that the politicians were witty themselves, whereas Kerry, can you imagine him being witty? Bush, I mean, genuine wit. But let's just, by way of contrast, remind ourselves. Here's LBJ. The Chancellor Erhard of Germany said to him, Mr. President, were you born in a log cabin? And he said, no, Mr. Chancellor, you're thinking of President Lincoln. I was born in a manger. That's LBJ. Or someone once said to him in front of him, John Kennedy is a great womanizer. And he says, hell, I've had more women by accident than he had by design. Now that's wit.
Okay. Wit, there's a president having fun. President now goes after reporters on what they're wearing or why the glum faces, he asked the day after the election. Let's get our listeners in here as well. John's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air. What do you think?
Yes, good morning. Hi, Tom. What has struck me is that the humor has become absolutely necessary. Anything that you hear out of the mouths of politicians, you can almost be certain is not the truth. When you get to the president, you can almost be certain that there is zero truth in it, and that goes for most of the whole administration. It's like you're living in an Alice in Wonderland. And then the press comes along, and they pull their punches. They do a little bit better. They get a little closer to it, but they don't really say how bad it really is. It's surreal now, so there's nothing left but comedy to do it, and I praise the comedians for going after it.
John, I think a lot of people feel exactly that way. So, Paul Lewis, here's the American viewer, listener saying, thank heavens, yes, it may be edgy sometimes, but thank heavens somebody's calling it like it is, even with a laugh line at the end. So?
I think it's true. The way that the whole country has come to feel about the disaster in Iraq is something that our comedians have been telling us about for years. Jon Stewart was calling it the Mesopotamia from the get-go. Bill Maher said the president had fought the long war and then lost it. So it seems to me that we are getting an edgier and perhaps more honest take on what's going on.
Let's dive in. Here's a long chunk from Jon Stewart, but it's very, very much on the news this week. Some of the networks decided, of course, to call the war in Iraq a civil war. Jon Stewart, it's a couple of minutes here, but you'll enjoy it. It's clearly illustrative. He talked about whether the term applied with Daily Show analyst John Oliver.
But getting back to the civil war...
The ongoing scuffle between sectarian insurgent groups.
Okay, but the...
Hold on. The internal sovereignty challenge, or the faith-based melee.
All right.
That's a nice one.
Why can't we just say and call it a civil war?
Because to American ears, the phrase civil war conjures horrible, jaw-dropping images of bloodshed panned across slowly by Ken Burns.
But in Iraq, the violence and bloodshed is horrible.
Yeah, no one needs the image. It's the image people don't like.
Oh, all right. If it's not a civil war, then what is it more akin to? Is it more akin to what happened in Vietnam?
Don't you say
is it Viet...
No, Mr. President!
Do you see, as some of your critics do, a parallel between what's going on in Iraq now and Vietnam?
No.
Did you hear him, John? No. That's a very hard argument to rebut. What with the N and the O? The president recognizes wars are like snowflakes, each similar, yet each unique, each, in its own way, capable of killing thousands of men.
Snowflakes can kill thousands of men.
If pushed.
All right. Certainly from an Iraqi perspective, what this is called makes no difference.
Oh, really? Really? Well, if you've lost a loved one in this conflict, and statistically, if you're an Iraqi, you have. Wouldn't you rather know it wasn't in a civil war, but rather a territorial argle-bargle of regional qualms?
3,000 Iraqis died just this month. To argue over what to call it seems like semantic quibbling.
Semantic quibbling? Well, I wouldn't call it that.
What would you call it?
A minor linguistic flare-up between two parties of differing terminological points of view.
And there we go, a territorial ogle-boggle, Paul Lewis. I mean, this really captures where humor is right now. The news riven all the way through this thing at the same time. Laughter on a lot of bodies.
Well, yes, but I would hope that most people, when they laugh at this kind of stuff, are not laughing at the death of civilians caught up in this or of our own servicemen, but they're laughing at the folly of an administration that took the country to war without a good rationale and without a good plan.
And yet, you warn us, when we laugh too much, too easily across the news, it may be a kind of evasion that's going on. At the same time, there's a kind of news, hard truth being brought right here. President Bush tries his hand at it. He had a few barbs for the White House press corps earlier this year during the final press conference before major renovations began on the White House press room. Let's listen.
Is that Sam Donaldson? Forget it. You're a has-been. We don't have to answer has-been's questions.
Mr. President, you want to say anything about the White House press corps, please?
Say something about the White House press corps?
Yes, sir.
It's a beautiful bunch of people.
Your best moment in here, sir.
My best moment in here is when my press conference ended. I can't hear you. I'm over 60, just like you. He was over 60 as well. At any rate, as you can tell, I'm thrilled to be here.
Wow, there it is. It's all a hoot in George W. Bush's press conference world. We're joined right now, as well, from New York by Gideon Evans. He's head writer for the new public radio comedy show Fair Game from PRI with Faith Saley. He's a former producer on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Gideon Evans, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Give us a sense of the boiler room at The Daily Show. Do politics drive it from the get-go? How's it work?
I would just say it's a lot of very smart people looking for funny angles on real stories. I mean, I don't know if there's any other way to say it other than that. It's just taking the news and finding the funniest possible angle and then writing towards that goal.
But when you look for the humor there, is it, all right, here's the headline, here's how the press is going with this, but we've got to get deeper. What's the joke that will do that?
I think you're right. You do have to get deeper, and I think a lot of that is because there are 20 different sources for satire these days. I mean, you have, you mentioned it, Saturday Night Live. You mentioned Bill Maher and Stephen Colbert, and I think there's so much competition, and with all that competition, you're forced to refine your humor and to be funny, and also to speak to the truth. I think, you know, if what you're making a joke about isn't true, then it won't be funny. Like, I know Mr. Paul Lewis over there works for Boston College, and if I made a joke based on the premise that Doug Flutie was a terrible quarterback for the Hurricanes, nobody would laugh.
Hey, wait a minute.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I would never do a joke like that, Paul.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Boston College man is much relieved. But what about this issue? You know, here we were in the long bit we just heard from John Stewart, just terrific on Civil War and all the rest. But at the middle of it, you've got that 3,000-plus dead Iraqi civilians. Did he ever have pause about kind of dancing with humor on that kind of grave?
I think we did, and I think it took a long time for us to feel comfortable doing jokes on those types of matters. I think if you look at early tapes of The Daily Show from the mid-90s or whatever, we probably weren't doing those types of jokes. But once September 11th happened, we were faced with this problem that there's no way around dealing with horribleness. It's just part of the way we live in our world. So you just have to think of a clever way of dealing with it. And I think Paul is right. That particular bit is more about the hypocrisy of arguing over semantics than it is about the dead soldiers. And I think that is how they got away with that brilliant comedy there.
Gideon Evans, let us listen to just a little bit of your own work here. When you took to the streets in England to ask why Americans are hated abroad.
Why do they hate us?
Do you think there's jealousy in Great Britain over the fact that America has so many great bands like the Rolling Stones?
I don't think you do. I think the Rolling Stones are a British band, as were the Beatles.
Well, we have ABBA at least.
ABBA is Swedish, I believe.
But we have Björk, at least.
Icelandic?
Well, Garth Brooks, then.
I've never heard of Garth Brooks.
We have him.
Why do they hate us?
There, Gideon Evans with his own little twist on Borat, in a way. Let me go to Matt, calling in from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What do you know?
This is a great show, as always. Well, first of all, I'm one of millions of people who I think modify their life so that they can watch The Daily Show and The Colbert Report every day. I'm a musician. I leave gigs early to get home to watch it. I set the alarm clock to get up in the morning. And I really have the sense that during this last year that the scales were falling from my eyes when I was watching those shows. Not only are these shows illuminating, but in some cases prescient. I don't know if you know about the Onion headline right after George Bush was elected president that said Bush's inaugural speech, at last our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity is over. And that, Paul Krugman actually referred to that as prescient. But I wanted to talk for a minute about Borat, who you mentioned, which I've seen twice and I think is incredibly brilliantly funny. And I know he's been very widely criticized, and there's some justification to the criticism, but I wanted to contextualize that as, you know, Sacha Cohen is doing something that's very much in the mainstream of American Jewish humor. In a way, he's like a combination of the Marx Brothers, like a postmodern Marx Brothers. The Marx Brothers would take our conceptions of what's acceptable behavior in social situations and throw grenades into it one way or the other. And his character is doing that and making amazing political statements at the same time.
Matt, we'll listen to just a little bit of Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat in just a second, but let me ask you, and I'll put it to the others, but do you think there's a danger of throwing grenades so much into the news that we sort of, in all this send-up, that we blow up our sense of seriousness? Or does it heighten your apprehension of the seriousness of circumstances?
I can only speak for myself. For me, it heightens the seriousness because you feel like you're being illuminated. And I know it's a danger to, in some respects, but you feel like you're seeing things as they really are. And when the news media is falling down on the job and not showing things as they really are, we refer to extremely smart humorists to do this for us.
I think you're getting right to the heart of it. And Matt, thanks for your call. Let's listen to a little bit of Borat, controversial new movie, but many have praised it enormously. With the pretend Kazakh journalist Borat, played by Sacha Baron Cohen. Here he's just been invited to sing the national anthem at a Virginia rodeo, but just before his big moment, Borat gets a lecture from a rodeo official on his mustache.
Of course, every picture that we give back from the terrorists or anything else, the Muslims, they look like you. Black hair and black mustache.
Yes.
Shave that young mustache off so you're not so conspicuous. So you look like maybe an Italian. or something.
Yes.
As far as from people looking at you. I see a lot of people, and I think there's a dadgum Muslim on what kind of bomb he's got strapped to him.
Yes.
And you probably aren't a Muslim. Maybe that's not your religion.
No, I am a Kazakh. I follow the hawk.
But you look like one.
Pretty muddy, but you can hear in there the rodeo official saying, hey, Vorat, shave that mustache. Every terrorist, every Muslim we see has a mustache looking like yours. It always leaves me thinking, there's a dadgum Muslim. I wonder what kind of bomb he's got attached to him. Now, okay, Paul Lewis, Sacha Baron Cohen puts this in front of us to say, here you are, America.
Yeah, here you are, America, a land where many people walk around with prejudices that should be dragged out into the light of common day to be ridiculed. In that same exchange, I believe that the rodeo official goes on to endorse the idea of shooting gay men. And that's only one of many prejudices that Borat, who's a kind of bigotry magnet, draws out of the people who come into his view.
Jack, Borat's a kind of special case here. He can leave you in tears of all kinds in this movie. But what about our caller Matt's point? He says he's looking to comedy now, religiously, every day. Gets up early, goes to bed late to get it. For a laugh, yes, but really for illumination, to get the scales off the eyes.
Well, I do, too. I watch those shows religiously. I've done that now over the past more than a year now. At the same time, I often feel when I'm watching them that, that there's a question really of moral seriousness that's being sort of glibly laughed aside. We're kind of amusing ourselves to death. For example, in that Stewart monologue, if he hadn't mentioned the number of people killed, it would be less objectionable, but we need to focus on that. And by the way, in America, that's 36,000 people.
The equivalent proportion
yes.
of population.
And these people have died because we have cracked open their society. And we are as responsible for that as we can be. And the proper reaction to that is almost, you know, is guilt and shame of what we have done.
So Gideon Evans, you were there with The Daily Show. You're with Fair Game now. Take that attitude into your writers' meeting. And do people just laugh and turn away? Or do they say, you've got a point, but we've got to make jokes anyway? What?
I just think if you parse it too much, if you make the comedy too complicated and you bring too many external things into it, it's just not going to end up funny. I think you can't bring that in. You do have to just go with your gut and do what you think is funny. But on the other hand, I do see Jack's point, and I think, you know, I mean, recently, we've all made some jokes about President Bush, but then when the president of Iran wrote a letter to the United States the other day, I can't even pronounce his name, so I won't.
Ahmadinejad, okay.
Yes, but when he starts bashing Bush, the letter was to the American public, and when he starts bashing Bush, it feels creepy. You're like, I'm allowed to do that, but not him. You know, it's kind of like I'm allowed to smack around my little brother, but nobody else.
So, Paul, here we are. We want to laugh. We have to laugh in a way, and there's illumination. Jack points also, as do you, to a risk here. Define that risk more precisely for us.
Well, it depends what you're laughing at. It's not the case that jokes about a particular subject are necessarily all harmful. But on the other hand, it is possible for jokes to do harm, and I'll give you an example. Jokes that ridiculed the UN weapons inspectors on the eve of the invasion of Iraq back in the winter of 2003.
Bumbling, fumbling, couldn't find them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they couldn't find them. They were so inept. We've got to go in. Well, guess what? We couldn't find them either. To the extent that those jokes were influential, or similar jokes told by someone like Rush Limbaugh about why pay attention to global climate change, that's an absurd menace that only an egghead like Al Gore would care about. Jokes like that do us real harm to the extent that they manage to persuade people to take it easy.
You mentioned Rush Limbaugh, Dennis Miller, also conservative jokes from the right. Here's a bit with comedian Dennis Miller, formerly host of his self-titled show on CNBC, talking about Iraq.
Do I want to get out of there? Sure I do, like everybody else. And I'm growing tired of the Iraqi people. I don't think they're loyal enough to us. I mean, one day you think they're on board, the next day they're ratting us out to the enemy. It's very unpredictable. It's like playing Stratego with Charles Manson. You know, he makes 7 good moves in a row, and you're thinking, wow, look at that. Charlie's getting it together. Next thing you know, he jams the dice up his... That's the Iraqi people to me.
Wow. Okay. So tough, angry, but in a funny way, presaging the sentiment. This is weeks or months ago, and he's already talking about being tired of the Iraqi people. That theme has emerged as a big one in Washington now. Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
We're good. What do you think, Paul?
My thing is that I think that the humor is so cheap because the audiences are just set up to laugh. If you look at that Letterman joke about John Kerry, they were laughing before he even got to the punchline, and they laughed at Michael Richards' apology about the racist comments he made. He had to actually explain to them that it wasn't like a bit, that he was actually serious in his apology. The audiences are just sitting there waiting to laugh, and I think it cheapens the humor and gives it an impact that it doesn't really deserve.
That's an interesting observation. Gideon Evans, you're in the biz. Do you serve a few drinks, and people come all, you know, ready to giggle at anything?
Yes, we give the audience amphetamines and, you know, cocaine. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, you're right. They are whipped up into a frenzy. And, you know, there was a certain unease I felt at times at The Daily Show when we wouldn't get laughs, but we'd get applause, and they'd kind of just be saying that they were agreeing with our point of view, but that wasn't what our job was as comedians and writers. So I always got uncomfortable, even though they loved whatever we were saying, when they kind of applaud and they're going woo-hoo, like they're agreeing with, you know, whatever angle we have, it made us feel a little uncomfortable.
On the other hand, you know, I, when I listen to The Daily Show, I can hear the interplay of joke and audience, and it's not always a giggle. They're ready to boo. I mean, there is a kind of political at-attention posture that you can hear in that audience. They'll go the other way, maybe easily cued by Jon Stewart, or is it the politics they bring to the party, Gideon?
I'm not sure about that. I think you're right, but I do think, you know, sometimes you'll see a guest come on who is a conservative, and the audience will be ready to boo them, and John will hush them up. But I do think you're right. They are very astute and very smart, and you do have to give them some credit, I mean, for that. Well, yeah, I'll give them credit. Why not?
Why not? What the heck? Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa. Ben's calling. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I was calling. I wanted to bring up a Pew Research study that was done a few years ago, and I don't have the specifics in front of me, but the findings of it were that the Daily Show viewers were more informed about current events than folks who got their news from other sources, including daily newspapers and television and things like that. And I thought that was so interesting because, to me, I thought it highlighted the sophistication of the humor, and not only that, but the reporting that's done on shows like The Daily Show, because they really seem to have to report the facts fairly clearly to then spin it and make a joke out of it.
So take the news, make a joke, but also bring the news. Stephen Colbert talked about that kind of dynamic in the press at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, roasting the media for overlooking big stories. Let's listen.
As excited as I am to be here with the president, I am appalled to be surrounded by the liberal media that is destroying America. With the exception of Fox News. Fox News gives you both sides of every story, the president's side and the vice president's side. But the rest of you, what are you thinking? Reporting on NSA wiretapping or secret prisons in Eastern Europe? Those things are secret for a very important reason. They're super depressing. And if that's your goal, well, misery accomplished. Over the last 5 years, you people were so good. Over tax cuts, WMD intelligence, the effect of global warming, we Americans didn't want to know, and you had the courtesy not to try to find out.
Jack Beatty, Stephen Colbert with a stick in the eye for the press corps right there. And the laughter, I wouldn't call it, bring the house down.
No, and that was, to me, the great humor of that whole occasion, that these panjandra, these mucky muckies of the Washington Press Corps with their, you know, $1,000 a table dinners were stone-faced.
We're talking this hour about politically charged humor today and its role in our society, our national conversation, from the president's barbed one-liners to Jon Stewart, Colbert, Bill Maher, Dennis Miller. All the rest, Gideon Evans is with us. He's head writer for the new public radio comedy show Fair Game from PRI with Faith Saley. Paul Lewis is here, author of the new book Cracking Up, American Humor in a Time of conflict. Here is Bill Maher delivering his new rules on his HBO show Real Time last month. He takes aim at President Bush, Fox News, and the shamed leader of the Christian right, Reverend Ted Haggard.
Last week, one of the biggest evangelical leaders in America, the Reverend Ted Haggard, was outed for drugs and extramarital gay sex with a male prostitute. Or as Fox News reported it, John Kerry hates our troops. Now, this was big news because Reverend Haggard was frequently at the White House and a big fan of President Bush, who he described as tan, supple, and firm where it counts.
Oh, boy. Okay. Sue's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Sue, what do you say?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a member of the Raging Grannies.
Raging Grannies. Oh. Humor at any age.
The Raging Grannies.
I am a woman of a certain age.
Yes.
Most of us have grandchildren, but we don't all, but we are all of a certain age. And a bunch of us, the New York Times covered an anti-recruitment demonstration featuring our 91-year-old member being hauled onto the police wagon.
So are you political humorists or political activists or both?
Both. We grow out of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, both Canadian and the U.S. And we find that, for one thing, humor, to make a point with humor, you have to be brief. So people have to hear it. And you have to work hard to be brief. I write some of the lyrics for the Raging Grannies songs. And we do a round of Fer Jaca only using Fer Menino, objecting to his support for the biolab that's being built here.
This is the Boston story of bioscience in the middle of a city. Yes, okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a weapons lab and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we have another one that we do on the Eensy Weensy Spider about Eensy Weensy microbes. People can join in. People can listen. They're not getting lectured, but they are getting news.
So what do you think of the role humor is playing now, Raging Granny? Is it good, or are we, you know, distracting ourselves from important things?
Oh, my God. We just had a show at Jimmy Tingle's. We got news. We got responses, things sent out from over 400 people who had never even heard of this lab. Now, that's a first step. I mean, there's a lot of...
So you get people engaged, and you get them laughing, and we hope you keep doing it. Sue, thanks very much for your call. Let me get another from Farmington, Connecticut. Sarah's on the line. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, everybody. I think that the humorist's work is very, very important, not only as an extension of freedom of the press, but as being sort of our conscience that a lot of us aren't willing to speak up about. And I think there's a tremendous historical precedent, and that is in the court jester. Of course, we're familiar with the court jester in Shakespeare's plays.
Sure.
But this was probably real, and the court jester was free to speak up and to criticize the king or the queen, to expose his foibles, and to speak up with impunity,
mm-hmm.
Without fear of punishment. And I think that this was very important for a kind of balance to be the public conscience. It often made people uncomfortable to have the king criticized at court.
But wrap it in humor and deliver a hard truth.
And deliver the hard truth. And I think that today's humorists are filling this very important function, and I applaud them, and of course I laugh at them, too.
That sounds like a good thing, as Martha Stewart might say. Paul Lewis, you're nodding, and yet you've got your reservations.
It's a good thing, and yet a new trend is that satirists and humorists are working for politicians. Some of them are not speaking to power, but they're speaking for power. When you have joke writers helping Bill Clinton navigate the Lewinsky affair, when you have joke writers scripting jokes that candidates put into their campaign speeches or responses, then in debates, then you have something that's much more manipulative. And when you have someone like Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage on radio who are sort of carrying some of the water for politicians in power by using quite pointed satire to make their observations come home, you know, I think that may be not so productive.
Yeah, Gideon Evans, is there a point at which we drag too much of our public conversation into the humor realm? I mean, you know,
we should lock them up. I don't think so. I think you can't blame someone that's hired as a comedian for Al Gore. I mean, Al Gore needs all the help he can get. He's dull as a stone. So, I mean, that's people's jobs. You know, there are public relations people that help out. beleaguered oil companies, and unfortunately, that's just the way our world works, or maybe fortunately. But I think thank God for humorous. I think, like, if you wake up in the morning and it looks like the world's on the precipice of apocalypse, and if we didn't have humorous, we probably would just, like, scream or jump out the window. So I think you have to say that humorous bring a positive, more positive than negative.
They sure bring relief, Jack.
Yeah, well, you know, we've come a far pace on this politicians hiring humorists and public relations people. In the 1952 campaign, Adlai Stevenson's people hired a public relations and sort of joke man for him, but he was mostly going to tell him how to deal with the media. And weeks went by that Stevenson didn't even see the man. And finally, late one night, the man's in a hotel in Chicago. He gets a call. Candidate Stevenson, could you please come up and help me in my room? Fellow comes up, he's ready with all his gags, with all his feints with the media, and Stevenson said, "Thank God you're here," and he pointed toward the television. He said, "How do you turn that on?" That was his public relations question. How do you turn that machine on?
Yeah, but they sure don't own all the humorous. Let's listen here to a little bit of John Stewart this week talking about George Bush's daughters, the Bush twins' visit to Argentina.
The president's twin daughters have also been on the road. They're celebrating their 25th birthday with a vacation in Argentina, where they're referred to as Jenna E. Barbara. And apparently their trip has caused what's known as chaos, to the point where, according to ABCNews.com, the American embassy and many Argentinian officials have strongly suggested the twins return to America. Just to repeat, Argentina, former safe haven for Nazi war criminals, is drawing the line at the Bush twins.
Okay, a little brass knuckle action there from John Stewart. Andrew's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thanks.
I'd just like to talk about comedy versus drama. It seems that the liberals use comedy and the conservatives use drama. I mean, look at Al Franken versus Bill O'Reilly. Look at, laugh at this or vote for us or die. And you asked what comedy is a sign of. You know, comedy is anger. And maybe the comedy is just getting better because we're so angry.
And drama is not? I mean, there have been a lot of conservative anger in this country, too, in the last some years.
Drama is fear.
Drama,
and that's
is
what the
fear.
Drama is working off of. And it's very different than the use of comedy. And I think it's much more effective, unfortunately.
Paul Lewis, you've looked at Rush and Bill O'Reilly and the rest and the kind of comedy that they wield. What do you make of Andrew's, what is it, comedy versus drama dichotomy here?
My sense is that on the right, we've had for years a kind of combination of real anger and mockery. I call it ragicule. And that it has a sort of persuasive force. It actually manages to simultaneously irritate us, get us all worked up about something, and also think that something else is ridiculous.
But John Stewart bringing up Nazi war criminals around the Bush war, the Bush daughters, is that not ragicule?
No, I don't think so. I think John Stewart is an ironist. He's 100% ironic about everything he discusses, and I don't think there's much anger in it at all.
Let's get another view on this left-right take on humor. Michael's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mega Dittos from Buffalo. A few comments. First of all, I love your show, and I'm probably a rare listener that loves Rush as well as NPR.
We're so glad to have you.
Before everybody congratulates themselves and slaps themselves on the back, that Pew Research poll number one, I hope people realize that Rush's audience is also very well informed as well as John Stewart's audience.
They listen a lot of hours. They get a lot of information, a lot of attitude, too. But yeah, sure, they're paying close attention.
I think John Stewart is a riot and very funny, but there's a very important distinction between Stephen and John and Rush and Bill O'Reilly, and that is that the vial that is sent out from Rush, yes, at the liberal media that he believes exists, but the common enemy is where he focuses most of his anger, and the cheering in the cars and in the offices is in agreement at that common enemy, whereas John Stewart's audience and Stephen Colbert's audience, the greatest applause, and 95, you know, this is not an official poll, of his jokes and his vile is against Fox. And Stephen Colbert's that you played, his comment against Fox News in front of the media, as you all congratulated, Rush Limbaugh makes these comments against the liberal media, and this is considered terrible. But again, what my point, a salient point that I don't want to go away from, is that the vile that Rush Limbaugh reserves and that humor that he uses it's focused on the enemy, whereas Jon Stewart, the enemy that he focuses his humor on.
But Michael, I want to understand, when you talk about the common enemy that Rush Limbaugh uses for his humor, who is that? What is that?
Well, the terrorists, Iran, Iraq, the people that we could all agree in, that those people, that's where our humor should be directed the most at, and that's what we need to laugh at and learn from each other.
You know, Rush Limbaugh clearly is a smart guy, even if you hate what he's got to say. And of course, a lot of people do, and a lot of people don't. But I've got to say, Michael, I've sure heard him hold up the left as a kind of common enemy of the right. I mean, I know it goes the other way as well, but I don't see him just focused on some third party standing outside this culture. That's for darn sure.
No, I agree, and that's dangerous, and it's not intellectually honest. But all that aside, there is a very strong element of Russia's show where he focuses on the common enemy. And I think that's something that is missing from Jon Stewart. There's not that clapping and cheering against the president of Iran or the enemies in Iraq. I think it happens much more often with the conservative base in the country, and that humor has to be more balanced against the common enemy.
We'll take your point, and we're chewing on it. Gideon Evans, what about this issue of left-right humor? Do you hear a fundamental difference in the approach?
I'm not so sure. It's just, there are so many outlets, it's tough to make a general statement. But I do want to talk about that drama versus comedy thing, and if I can go off-point on point.
Okay.
Aristotle had written a long treatise on comedy. And unfortunately, he'd written a long treatise on comedy and a long treatise on tragedy, and the one about comedy was lost. And I think that's the problem we're having here today. I think it's just we need that treatise in order to figure it all out. I just don't know if we have the answers.
Well, that's deep, my friend. That's as deep as Aristotle. David's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm concerned about a growth of malevolence in the comedy that cuts across the political spectrum. It's coming from both sides, and I think that is indicative of a loss of civility in society, and that we're losing focus on who we are.
You know, David, I'm actually very sympathetic with that. Not that I don't laugh, not that it's not funny, not that anger isn't appropriate, but Jack, let me put David's point to you. I do wonder sometimes if the country hasn't become so polarized that we don't know how to speak in plain civil terms to one another, so we retreat to the kind of bomb-throwing of humor. It's a great spectacle, but if it's there in the absence of a genuine conversation, that worries me.
Yes, and when it's always laughing to the choir, you know, I mean, Jon Stewart, I don't see how a conservative could watch that show with any satisfaction. And the old function of humor, at least my recollection of a Jack Benny or a Bob Hope or Johnny Carson, is that there was a unifying thread there, that this wasn't divisive humor, that the whole country could laugh at the same thing and find it funny. Whereas now, just in the kind of humor we've displayed here, quoting from people, it's clear that there's a Dennis Miller sort of humor and a Rush sort, and then there's the Jon Stewart kind, and the two don't meet. And I do think that does, in a way, just kind of make even humor an index of our division.
Paul, what do you say?
Well, I think in one sense we are cracking up as a country in terms of the sorts of humorists that we like, but we've been discussing figures who are at one political end or the other of the spectrum, and in the middle, I don't think Jack should worry
there
about it. Well, take all of the regular late-night monologuists. They're certainly the most widely seen comics in the country, and their material is politically bland. Even when it's political, it's more likely to be about the personal foibles of Bill Clinton or Ted Kennedy or George Bush than about their policies.
Bland and maybe held in common in that way, but then it doesn't seem as at grips with the times. There's a dilemma. Polly's calling from Farmington, Connecticut. Hi, Polly, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I think that humor is extremely important. I think it's therapeutic. Without humor, I think I would be in a deep blue funk, because there's so many bad things going on in the world, and it also gives you another kind of vision of what's going on. If you can laugh at it, you can look at it.
Absolutely. Another perspective on it, and it can be a very tough one these days, but Lord knows we need to laugh. Let's get one more little bit of Stephen Colbert. He's been kind of our voice thread through the hour. Here he is once again at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, suggesting the press might have an easier time if they just followed the cues of the White House.
Listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
So funny, it hurt to laugh. Gideon Evans, you've got comedy now on public radio. What about your boundaries there compared to Comedy Central?
Well, I think, you know, we're piloting the show now. We're going national in January, and we're finding our way. I think we're hoping to be a little bit dangerous, but you know, we also want to have a balanced opinion. We don't want to we want to be equal opportunity offenders over here and go for the same types of young audiences that Comedy Central has.
You're a diplomat and a scholar, and we look forward to your humor as well. A little bit dangerous, I guess you've got to be in humor these days, maybe anytime. Gideon Evans, head writer for Fair Game from PRI with Faith Saley. Thanks very much for being with us, Gideon.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Paul Lewis, a final thought, taking us to heaven or hell, or where are we headed on this humor bandwagon?
Well, I think we're headed in different directions all at the same time, and the point I would make is that people should pay attention to jokes when they seem to be doing something more than just amuse, when they seem to be trying to push us in one direction. Most humor doesn't. Some does.
These days, it seems like an awful lot does almost all the time. Keep an eye on your soul as you keep an eye on your laugh button. Paul Lewis, author of Cracking Up, American Humor in a Time of Conflict, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, my friend, have a great weekend, and please keep on laughing.
I'll do it. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.